You're tuned in right now to 8:30 a.m. KSDP. We're in Sandpoint, Alaska, all across the Aleutians East Borough as well. And as promised, we are going live with Mr. Mark Begich. Mark Begich was the mayor of Anchorage, also the senator for the state of Alaska to the United States, the federal senator, and now he is running for governor of Alaska as the Democratic Party candidate, and he's live with us right now. Mr. Begich, thank you so much for coming on the air today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much. It's always great to be back on your show and be able to talk to you and your questions, but also to hopefully tell some folks out there what's going on in the campaign, what some of the big issues are. But thanks.
Thank you. And I'm joined by Holden Feldbauer. He's going to be starting to field some questions right now. So, Holden, take it away.
All right. How you doing, Mr. Begich? We got a
very good. Thank you.
We got a nice easy opener here. Why should people in rural communities vote for you?
I like those softballs in the morning. I appreciate it. So, first I'll say this, that, you know, I got into this race because I felt like there were so many issues that we were not addressing as a state. When you think about Alaska as, you know, the highest in crime now in the nation, we have the highest unemployment, we're now 46 out of 50 states when it comes to our educational system. You know, when you think about it, these statistics are really not the statistics that move us into the future for Alaska and create a great opportunity. We also, in the last year, lost over 3,000 people left the state because they saw no opportunity. And the fastest growing percentage of people leaving are from our millennial population. So we have a lot of challenges ahead of us, and I didn't think that the current administration was leading us down and into the future for where Alaska needs to be. And I would say that Senator Dunleavy, who's the Republican opponent, really wants to take us backwards in time. I didn't think any of those were positive things. The other reason I decided to get into the race was there's so many people, and I will say in rural Alaska, but all across the state, that just do not feel like the system is really responding to their needs. And there's a lot of people who have, you know, lobbyists and people that can go to Juno and bang on the doors of power, but the reality is the majority of Alaskans don't have time for that. We're working, we're trying to make a living, people are working 2-3 jobs, and I felt it was necessary to give a choice to people that, you know, I want to be down there with my running mate, Deborah Call, to really fight for the needs of Alaskans and fight for the folks that don't have, you know, don't have a seat at the table of power, and try to break open that door and give them a chance. And I think that is a huge need. When you think of just specifically rural Alaska, you know, I think of the programs we've laid out on our website on Begich.com, a lot more detail. But when I think about the issues that we've been talking about, you know, recognizing tribes, making sure, as the federal government has, that federal recognition of tribes, the state has to continue that, but also create some permanency to that. So it's not dependent on who's the governor, but really it's a process that ensures that the tribes are recognized across the state as legitimate government-to-government relationships with our state. Second, I think I want to continue to move forward in the compacts with our tribes. We've done great work with health care, some around justice, but I think there's more opportunity there. Along with that, I think there's a great opportunity to push the envelope regarding education. We're having a great struggle, as I mentioned at the beginning, about where we stand from an educational standpoint. And I think we need to do everything we can to expand and think with some innovation of how we work with maybe tribes to deliver education throughout the state. And a couple other items that I think are very, very important. And that is, you know, the state has a goal to move to 50% renewable energy by 50% by 2025. The challenge is they really haven't stepped up to the plate. I want to make that much more aggressive because, as you know, in rural Alaska, there's huge needs for us to ensure that we have the most energy efficient, but also lowering the cost of energy in our communities, because they're just strangling the ability for some of the communities to survive, excuse me, because the cost of energy is just too high. So I think there is an array of issues. And as I said at the beginning, you know, I have traveled, you know, throughout rural Alaska. The issues that I talk about education, growing the economy, how to make our communities safer, all directly related not only to urban Alaska, but clearly rural Alaska, and making sure there is a clear understanding that, you know, you cannot, a state cannot survive without a strong communities within rural Alaska.
All right. That's a nice, concise answer there for rural Alaskans to look forward to. I would like to move on to the PFD now. So you've come out pretty strongly for a full PFD. However, because of the actions of the legislature, could you, if elected as governor, make that promise to your supporters and people that would vote for you?
Yeah, what I've laid out is a permanent fund dividend plan, that a PFD plan that is really, I think, based on sustainability. And what I've done is I've said we should take the formula, the percent of market value that the legislature came up with, but constitutionalize it. Why would that be important? If you constitutionalize the dividend, then you know it's no longer a political football with the politicians in Juneau. You get it out of their hands. It's based on a formula. It's in the Constitution. The voters vote for it, hopefully, and then only the voters can change it. This year would have been about a $2,100 dividend. And the other half of the flow of the money that's coming from the permanent fund would go to education. Same thing. We'd constitutionally guarantee education, making sure that we no longer have these battles that they have every single year on how big the budget should be or not be. And what they end up doing most of the time is slicing and dicing education, which is really impacting our long-term health of the state. Because if you don't have a great public education system, you will see a degrading of your economy, your social fabric, and the ability for the state to become a great state. And I think the way I've designed it is really the main crux of it is get it out of the hands of these politicians. Get it so it's a formula. Put it in the Constitution. It will take a vote of the people. I feel very confident that they would do this. I'm the only one in this campaign that's talked about putting it into the Constitution. The governor's plan leaves it in the hands of politicians, which I think is a high risk. The other folk, Senator Dunleavy talks about it, but only talks about ensuring he'll protect it. But the reality, when he was in the state Senate, he had more than a dozen times to vote to protect the dividend. He didn't do it. When the governor vetoed the amount, Senator Dunleavy voted not to override the veto by tabling the motion. This is, you don't get to do one thing in your record and then come out and then campaign on another way. And I think what's happened here on the dividend has become pretty politically charged. And I've just laid out exactly what I hope to do. I think it's important because just, when you think about a family or an individual over the last 3 years, imagine if you had another $4,000 to $5,000 in your economy per person, the amount of economic opportunity that would be. Well, that's how much has been eliminated from an individual for their dividend cuts that have occurred by the legislature and by the governor. And I think that has had a huge impact in the ability for the economy, especially in rural Alaska. When you think of some of the areas, for example, in western Alaska, where the average income is $15,000 to $18,000, and you take that income away from them from the dividend, it has a direct impact to their ability to continue to move forward and pay their bills and survive. And I just think, anyone who calls this, doing the dividend was a courageous move, it's not courageous to put the burden on the backs of the people who can least afford it. And that's what happened with this legislation. So my goal is put it in the Constitution, have the people protect it, about a $2,100 dividend this year, take it out of the hands of the politicians, and then the other half of the flow of money, put it into education, which is a great equalizer and a great opportunity for us as Alaskans. My opponents don't have plans like this. They don't want to put it in the Constitution. One wants to leave it in the legislature. Well, both of them actually want to leave it in the hands of politicians, which I think would be a huge mistake. And one had a chance, in the case of Senator Dunleavy, to protect it multiple times and never did it.
Okay. Well, looking at the state of Alaska's budget deficit, we've brought it down from about $3 million to roughly, I think, $700 million we're at now. And because of this, do you think Alaskans are safe as far as the budgetary crisis is concerned?
No, because that is not a permanent fix. What they did is they've been using every single year money from the savings account, one-time money that they have spent 80% of it, $14 billion of the savings account is gone. So we don't have a lot of money left there now to patch the budget. And, you know, sadly, if they would have taken that money in the first year when the governor came in and put that into the permanent fund and used the earnings off of that alone, they would have filled the gap today. But they didn't do it. What they did is they had a short-sighted idea. They patched the budget with one-time money. And it's like taking your savings account and paying your utility bills. You know, the utility bills don't go away. They come back. But for them to spend their one-time money like this was, I think, reckless and does not give us a long-term fiscal plan. We have to do what I believe is three steps. One, as I mentioned, on the permanent fund, you got to take that off the deck so you protect it and no longer can they go after it and use it for their own needs down in Juneau. Take the other portion, as I said, use it for education. By the time you're done, you still have maybe, as you said, maybe $500-700 million deficit. What I know is going to happen, we're going to have some revenues, but we're going to work with the legislature to figure out how that package will work and how everyone's going to participate, maybe individuals to companies, but everyone needs to help give us a long-term stable fiscal plan. But the way they've done it, it's good for a year and a half, and then they're going to be right back into this pile, and they're never going to have an answer unless they deal with this directly, and it's not going to be easy. And anyone who says this is all over and done with is just not correct.
You know, you raise a really good point there, Mr. Begich, about the need for what some would call new revenue or just, you know, taxation in general. And, you know, we aren't obviously clear of the budgetary crisis with $700 million still on the chopping block. And then we have not like the savings that we had before, as you said, burned through about, I think, $12 billion in savings over the last 4 years, which is really a difficult situation. But I think that I wanted to push you to find out what you would do here, because if we've learned anything over the last few years watching Governor Walker and the Alaska State Legislature try to navigate this issue, it's that, you know, and you're going to run into this if you're elected, you know, the Republican majority in the Senate and then the large portion that was in the House outside of the House majority coalition, they did not want to put any new taxation in there. And, you know, Governor Walker put up every tax option possible and nothing was able to get through. Now, as a Democrat, I would imagine it's not a far stretch to imagine that you're going to have similar problems dealing with a legislature that might be coming from the opposite party. Why do you think that you can navigate these waters differently and bring about new taxation revenue or other means of closing the budget gap?
Yeah, no, that's a great question and a great way to kind of ask it in the sense of what are you going to do differently, basically. Well, first off, you know, when you leave money on the table, in this case, the governor left a savings account on the table, they're going to, you know, elected officials, especially legislative bodies, will take the path of least resistance, and that's what they did. They just took away and grabbed pieces of that savings account, and what he should have done is you got to take it off the table. Now it's gone. The only thing now left is the earnings reserve, and that's $18 billion. That's the permanent fund earnings reserve, $18 billion, which these guys down in Juneau could take that also and peel it away. That's about, like I said, $18 billion. They just need a simple majority. And what I've suggested is to take almost $14 billion of that and put that into the corpus of the dividend. The first thing you have to do is you have to take away all the kind of easy access money, because if they don't have that money on the table, then they have to make more long-term decisions. But as long as that money is available, they'll take $400 million or $600 million every year, because no one in their mind, from their perspective, will notice it. Well, of course we will, because over the next several years, when that's diminished, the net result is you have no more money left to actually plug the gap. So first thing you got to do is take that kind of loose change. I know it doesn't sound like, when I say loose change, it's, you know, it's $18 billion, a lot of money. But you got to take that off the table, put it in the corpus of the permanent fund so they cannot spend it. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was going to say, is that possible for the government to do, or would that take legislative action to move that earnings?
it takes legislative action, but here's the what you know, the governor never really did. You know, when they kept spending the money out of the savings account, he never threatened to veto them. And what you have to do is say, look, if you don't do this, and plus the public, you know, I think I'd win the public relations war in that. And that is, I want to put more money into the corpus of the permanent fund and protect it for generations to come. I think I'd have a much better argument out there. And if they don't do that, then I have no problem in vetoing the budget, because you have to do that to force them to make these tough decisions. I had to do this when I was mayor of Anchorage. When I came in, the Anchorage Assembly was spending all the one-time money to fill the gap. And what I told the Assembly, which was a wide range and a lot of conservatives on there, I said, look, if you bring me a budget that spends the savings, I will veto it. And they didn't do it. And then we rearranged and dealt with our revenues. We increased revenues. We did all the things we were needing to do to create a sustainable budget. And that's what you have to do in the state. As long as they have these pools of money that they can draw from one time, they'll do it. So you got to take those off the deck. And then you have to build these relationships, which I don't think the governor has done a very good job with the majority as well as the minority. You know, the majority in the House, for example, Democrat coalition brought forward a comprehensive budget plan, went to the Senate, and then the governor met with the Senate, and then the deal fell apart, and the governor decided, well, I'll just do the permanent fund. Well, that's unacceptable. You should have told the Senate, if you don't bring me a comprehensive budget plan, I will veto the budget. That is the power of the governor's office, and he didn't do it, and we ended up spending out the savings and putting the burden on the people who could least afford it by cutting the dividend and never solve the long term. That's how you got to do it. I've done it all my life. And, you know, being in the Senate, for example, when you have to deal with Bernie Sanders to Ted Cruz, I'm going to tell you, if you can deal with those different personalities, there's a lot of opportunity to work with the legislature to get things done.
All right. Moving away from the more fiscal-oriented part of the interview, I'd like to bring it back. You said at the top that Alaska is number one in violent crimes in the nation, and I wanted to kind of touch on public safety. Do you think SB 91 should be scrapped or should be modified, and how would you modify it?
Well, I think SB 91, as you know, this last session, or special session they did, because people might have forgot there was 8 special sessions the legislature had. They brought in SB 54, which did some modifications to it. But the challenge is, in the mind of the public, right or wrong, they believe that this bill has caused all kinds of criminal activity to increase. The fact is, criminal activity had been increasing year in and year out. In the last 4 years, we got to the top of the tier now, number one in the nation. So SB 91 by itself is not the answer. And also, those that want to repeal it, I know they support things within. I think you have to just put that aside and figure out what's the longer-term plan for public safety. What I've recommended is several steps. And again, on my website, there's more detail on baggage.com, but here's a couple things that you have to do. You have over 40 state trooper positions fully funded but unoccupied, meaning they don't have positions filled. We need to fill those. Corrections officers, 20 police or corrections positions fully funded but not filled. We have to fill these positions to ensure that we have the workforce we need. Second, we have to think more creative in how we deal with crime. I would set up a mini cabinet made up of public safety, corrections, the attorney, U.S. or the AG, the Health and Human Services, Law Department. These guys need to be in the court system all together, working together to figure out how we're going to combat this problem. Because in rural Alaska, we have to do better with our village police officers, our tribal officers, make sure they have the resources that they need to fund them appropriately, but also the training and the standards that we need. Now, we just saw a village police officer, a tribal officer, just a couple days ago in the paper, who has been arrested for sexual assault. And, you know, we need to raise the level to make it a profession, not just a part-time situation. Second, we need to make sure that with our current troopers and future troopers that we have a decent retirement program, because right now many are leaving and not staying because we don't have a long-term commitment to them as a retirement program. Third, We need to be innovative. For example, a sizable amount of the drugs that are coming into rural Alaska are coming through our postal system. What I would do is put a couple troopers as well as a couple drug dogs working with the postal inspectors, assign them to the U.S. Post Office. Let the Post Office manage them, but we'll pay for them. Because here's why. When you use that opportunity, you can increase the capture or the ability to grab the drugs out of the postal system from 1% to 30 to 40%. Once you start doing that, drug dealers will understand that that business is no longer profitable for them to try to push it through the postal service because we're capturing their product, and then we're going to prosecute them under federal law, which means they will serve these drug dealers up to 10 years minimum in federal penitentiary. Then you have to remind ourselves that 80% of the people in corrections have an addiction, 80%. And we know there are people who want to get on the right track, and what we need to do is focus on some of that preventive activity, maybe wellness court treatment programs. We have to recognize that as a part of the equation here. People are feeding their addiction through crime, and we have to be aggressive about it and not just wait for them to commit the third or fourth or fifth offense. And then in that process of doing that, we also have to refocus our energies on first-time youth offenders, making sure that they're getting on the right track so they don't become long-term criminals or issues with addiction. I think there is a multifaceted approach, but this whole idea that, you know, everyone talks about SB 91 as the magic solution is just incorrect. And now they say the magic solution is get rid of it. Well, what's amazing that my two opponents, Senator Dunleavy, allowed it to go through the committee that he was on, and then the governor signed the bill. Now they both have amnesia on it and trying to make it sound like, well, they don't know what it's all about and what a mistake. Well, they poorly funded it, and they didn't focus on how it was going to be implemented. So that's the approach I would take. There's a lot more detail to this on my website, but you have to have a multifaceted approach, work with your local communities, create a statewide cabinet that focuses on this, deal with drug interdiction, and making sure you start cutting off the flow into rural Alaska, deal with first-time offenders in a proper way, and then also don't forget the young people and try to do preventive action so they're not getting down this path to crime.
That's a lot of interesting things. I'd love to go in deeper there, but obviously we're going to be limited on time. I do have a question for you, kind of to give you a bit of a twist. You know, Governor Walker came on and he was talking about the direct link, and I think you were kind of hinting at it, of the crime rate to the opioid epidemic, and that they kind of go hand in hand with one another, and that SB 91 wasn't the full blame for why crime went up. There was just kind of a perfect storm of issues that occurred. Now, I think that with the opioid epidemic, we're starting to see the increasing idea that this is a health issue, not solely a criminal issue, and that you're seeing some more novel approaches coming along from other places. In Philadelphia, they're talking about opening up a safe injection facility, and they're talking about the same thing in New York. As a governor, would you be open to some of these more traditionally controversial approaches, but maybe ones that haven't been tried? How would you feel if Anchorage wanted to open a safe injection facility, or if there was other treatments that maybe weren't as traditional, but people were starting to move towards?
You know, I'm not going to close any option to look at how we deal with this addiction, but let's broaden it if we can. You know, for example, today it's opioids. You know, a few years ago it was meth, then it was crack, then it was heroin. You know, the problem we have is it's kind of the drug of, you know, the new drug of the day that we focus on. And what we need to do is go back to the core issue, and that is addiction. People have addictions, and we who are in the criminal justice system, and we need to deal with this in a different way than what we've been doing. Because if we had this conversation 3 years ago, maybe 4 years ago, we would have been talking about meth and how it was a scourge. You know, Wasilla was nationally recognized as the meth capital because of all the problems they had. You know, but we have to look at this from a longer and much more broader perspective of how we're going to deal with individuals' addictions. And there'll be a lot of money coming from the federal government because it's the drug of today, and that's opioids. There'll be a lot of money. What I want to do with that money is not just focus on opioids, but I want to focus on this broader issue of addiction. And here's an example. when someone's in the criminal justice system and they've been in there for opioids and they're trying to come off of it and they use an alternative drug to slowly bring them off, I think it's called Vivitrol. Well, the problem with that is it's only good for about 28 days, and as soon as that wears off, you're back into your, you know, free crash there. And when you're coming off a high like that, if you've ever seen someone come off and they're not have their treatment, it is a bad situation. They'll go right back to the streets. And here's the challenge, which is crazy. Here's a individual, they're coming out, they're trying to get clean, they're on the treatment program 28 days. They qualify for Medicaid, but they can't sign up for Medicaid until 30 days. So those 2 days will put them into an enormous risk of being back on the street. And, you know, both of these programs are run by the state. We should link these up so we keep the treatment and try to figure out how to move these people to the right direction. On top of that, with the opioids, you know, there's a lot of other, you know, I know they've restricted. We, you know, states finally got onto a lawsuit to sue these drug companies. But we also, you know, if you want to talk about pain management, you know, you don't always need drugs. There's all kinds of other opportunities. But people are addicted to a variety of kinds of drugs and alcohol, and that's our focus should be. And we have to think of new and innovative ways to deal with these addictions. So, you know, I'm not sure if any of those that you've described would work in Alaska, but I would say this, that as we invest in more programs like wellness courts — they used to be called drug courts, but they're called wellness courts — where you involve the family all together in getting someone clean, that's what we should be doing. And that's the kind of innovation that if we don't do, we're just going to be back. You know, I don't know what the drug will be 2 years from now, but there'll be some other thing that people get addicted to, and then you and I will have this exact same conversation because we're not dealing with the core issue of addictions.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Begich. I know your time is limited, but we've got about two more questions for you regarding social policy here in Alaska. Governor Walker and a lot of the Aleut corporations have come out very strongly against ballot measure one, but where do you stand on the issue?
I am for ballot proposition one. I think, you know, our fishing industry is one of the most important industries we have, not only for this generation but for generations to come. It has an incredible renewable capacity. But I would also say this, that this proposition, 45,000 Alaskans petitioned their government because the government didn't respond, and now they are trying to get some process that will allow the Alaskan to give comment in regards to issues that are related to fisheries in this state. So if there's a big mega project happening, then the goal is this would, if this passed, they would give them a shot to be able to make comment, be able to be part of the process, and if they think something's wrong, an opportunity to appeal it. So from my perspective, I think it's, you know, a positive step. I know there's some concerns people have, but at the end of the day, I think it's more important that we don't forget on these big projects that we have to give people the right to have their voice heard, and I believe that's what this piece of this initiative does. Now, I know the opposition believes that it's going to wipe out the world and Alaska will be a desert of economic opportunity. There won't be any. I disagree with that. You know, these are the same people that did not want to have the Coastal Zone Management Program, which is now gone, which we have no right to have any comment now on our Coastal Zone Program, which is amazing. The governor could have put this back in 4 years ago. He didn't. I will. But I would say that, you know, it's the same forces. They just don't want oversight of the projects they're working on, and I think Alaskans deserve the right to make a comment and have a part of the process.
All right. That's very good. I just wanted to give you a chance now to get any closing statements, maybe touch on things that we didn't ask you about and you feel are very important for your stance, both running as running for governor.
Sure. Well, I think we covered a lot of ground here in this last 30 minutes. I really appreciate it. I think it's important that people look at the choices that we have in front of us here. You know, I think, you know, there's one candidate that wants to go back in time. There's another candidate that wants to kind of stay where they're at. And I believe we need to move to the future. I think it's an important direction if we want to be a stronger and better state. And when we look at the statistics that I laid out, I think, you know, everybody would agree that we could do better than where we are. And I think that's the plan that we have, that, you know, staying where we are is not acceptable. We can do better than what we've seen in the last 4 years in the sense of all of our statistics, and I really feel like Alaska has great opportunity, but we need the leadership, the leadership that is not afraid to take on tough challenges, but also recognizes the importance of our young people and what they could contribute to the long-term future of this great state. I want to push that forward. I want to be part of that, and I know my travels throughout Alaska have shown me so much talent and so much opportunity that people want to be part of something. And in this really toxic environment we're in politically, people are looking for something fresh, that's new, that's not stuck in the mud, but thinking about the future. And I believe that's what this campaign's about, and I'd encourage people to go to my website at baggage.com and find out more about the campaign. If you want to help and support the campaign, feel free to volunteer, give a donation. That makes a big difference to keep our message on air. But at the end of the day, this election is about the future and how we're going to move us down the path.
All right. Thank you, Mark Begich. I appreciate you coming down here and talking to KSDP again.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Begich. It was wonderful to talk to you again, as always, and hopefully we can get you on one more time.
All righty. I look forward to it. Thank you, guys. Have a great day.
You do the same.
Good. Bye-bye.